You're listening to Midori Hao's first broadcast on the 4th of November 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Markus Hippi, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's news agenda with George Brock, head of journalism at City University here in London. George, what do you have for us this morning?
Good morning. Phone hacking, the trial of ex-president Morsi of Egypt, a CIA double agent, and looted Nazi art.
More from George a bit later. We'll also be in North Mitrovica to speak to Guy Deloni following Kosovo's municipal elections.
We will not, never, will not never recognize independent institution of Kosovo or institution of Kosovo in the north. We really don't want to be a part of that kind of monster state.
Also on the program, we'll examine the ancient history of social media with author Tom Standage.
And we'll go on a tour of the revamped HQ of London auctioneers Bonhams.
The thing is to create a little bit of magic and to turn weakness into strength, to turn a very narrow, as I say, a very narrow and unpromising approach into something that inspires you.
So all that plus, we'll also play some music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the headlines with David Spencer.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. Ousted Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi has arrived at a Cairo police academy to face trial in what opponents of the army-backed government say is part of a campaign to crush his Muslim Brotherhood. It's the second time in just over 2 years that an overthrown president has been in court in Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood has said it will not abandon street protests, and the country is on high alert. Morsi and 14 other Islamists are charged with inciting violence. Time magazine's Jared Malzin has told us that the hearing underlines the problems the country is facing.
The current government that's backed by the military is trying to project an image of stability and confidence and saying we're moving forward with the political process we set up. But with Morsi set to reject the authority of the court and his supporters also set to do that, this is just recalling the fact that there's really a very deep lack of consensus about this political process.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry will hold talks in Saudi Arabia later, with Egypt expected to feature on the agenda. But the kingdom's frustration with a lack of progress on the Syria crisis is set to dominate proceedings, with Saudi Arabia believing the United Nations hasn't done enough to stop the bloodshed. Saudi Arabia is also frustrated with Washington's diplomatic engagement with Iran, and a senior Saudi prince has warned that the kingdom could shift away from the United States. At least 18 people have died after a plane crashed in heavy rain in Bolivia's northern Amazon region. The pilot and co-pilot of the Aerocon aircraft survived and are in a serious condition in hospital. The turboprop plane caught fire as it landed in a remote town near the border with Brazil. Outbreaks of violence have marred key elections in Kosovo. Masked men forced the early closure of the main polling centre in an ethnically mixed Kosovan town during the municipal elections. They burst into the building, setting off tear gas canisters and smashing ballot boxes. Ethnic Serbs were encouraged to vote for the first time, but as polls closed late on Sunday, there were concerns of a low turnout. Thousands of protesters have taken to the streets of Bangkok after lawmakers approved a draft political amnesty bill on Friday that could allow the return of self-exiled former premier Thaksin Shinawatra. The bill's opponents say it's an attempt by the ruling party to whitewash his alleged corruption. Although it could be weeks before the bill becomes law, the protests in Bangkok, including royalist groups and members of the opposition Democrat Party, threaten to disturb months of relative calm in a country scarred by bloody unrest in 2010. The mayor of Toronto, Rob Ford, has used his regular radio broadcast to apologise for any mistakes he's made, but again refused to quit after police said they'd recovered a video appearing to show him smoking from a crack pipe. Despite mounting pressure, Mr. Ford, who's denied smoking crack, said he had no reason to resign and planned to run in the next election. He's challenged the police to release the video to the public.
I want the police chief, Bill Blair, to release this video for every single person in the city to see. Whatever this video shows, Toronto residents deserve to see it, and people need to judge for themselves what they see on this video.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David. It is 5 minutes past the hour here in London. David will be back at the bottom of the hour with another check of your world headlines. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です。
London, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. This is the time of the programme when we tell you the big stories you should keep in mind today. And we are joined by George Brock, Head of Journalism at City University here in London. George, welcome to the programme.
Good morning.
What would you like to start with today?
Well, I think we mustn't forget the phone hacking trial going on at the Old Bailey. It's a little bit British domestic, but it is in some ways an international story because it is the crash of one of the largest press groups the world has ever seen, the News Corporate, Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation. And here we have on trial for months to come, two of the most powerful people in the Sun and the News of the World, the two really big papers of the past that really kind of held the ring in the popular in popular journalism, Rebecca Brooks and Andy Coulson. And this trial is going to last a long time because it's multiple defendants, multiple charges, and we still haven't finished the prosecution outlining its case. A lot of people haven't seen, I think, that phone hacking, which is what kind of started this and has kind of given it its name, are the least important charges on the sheet. The toughest charges are what is called in British law conspiracy to pervert the course of justice, often involving the concealing of evidence from the police, and also the bribery of public officials. And the prosecutor hasn't even started telling us the story, the outline of how he's going to deal with this part of the case. And when he was doing the rest of his outline last week, he dropped about one really big news detonation every day. So the odds that we're going to get something exciting today seem to me quite high.
It is quite fascinating that this trial has been on for less than a week, but there's been some amazing charges laid against Rebecca Brooks, especially. And when you hear the stories of how she went to actually try to cover up what was happening, it is quite startling.
Yes, but don't forget that big criminal trials always start like this. The prosecutor gets the stage, in this case, for practically a week on his own. Nobody has a chance to contradict him. There's no questioning, nothing. And, you know, if you are defense counsel, or indeed actually you're the defendants in these trials, the way the format works is you just have to bite your lip a lot at the beginning. You don't get your say until a lot later on. So, like they say in football, game of two halves. We have to know what the defense case is before we can see how it's going to go.
There's also another trial that has begun today in Cairo, the trial of ex-president Morsi. Do you see any similarities between these two?
No, absolutely none at all. They could hardly be more different as trials. The Morsi trial is being held in a police academy under what will be enormously heavy security because they're very afraid of violent demonstrations. They switched the location of the trial at the very last moment. And Egypt, I think, is unique in the world at the moment as the only country which has two ex-presidents on trial. Don't forget the trial of ex-president Mubarak, the man who fell in the original Egyptian popular demonstrations, is still actually on trial in the same police academy when that trial is running. I don't think that President Morsi is going to recognize the court. All his advisors and people who've been talking to the media have said he won't. He doesn't want to legitimize it. So it will be chaotic, messy, and very difficult to foretell the outcome. But it is very unlikely that he's going to go back into public circulation. The army have kept him out of sight ever since arresting him some weeks ago.
Well, he says he doesn't want to legitimize this court. Of course, many people saying that this is entirely a complete charade because everyone who's involved in this trial has been appointed by the military leadership who is now running the country. Lots of questions over whether this trial will be televised. Do you think that's something that will go ahead? And if it does, how would that play amongst the Egyptian populace?
Well, this is effectively an authoritarian military regime now running Egypt. They will only televise the trial if they think it is to their advantage. And frankly, if I was asked to guess, I would have thought it's pretty unlikely they're going to do that. The Egyptian military have jammed themselves now in a position under which about 1,000 people have been killed since July, when the Hardline faction took over. Most of those people are opponents of the military regime. So they really now are being run by people who believe that they can only hold the whole state and society together. That's the military belief, if you see what I mean, if they kill people. That's a pretty bad position to be in. The American Secretary of State, John Kerry, was in Cairo yesterday, apparently by coincidence, and he said he thought that Egypt was, and I quote, on the right track. It's a bit difficult to see what he meant.
Today, there are tens of thousands of police officers on the streets in Egypt when this trial has begun. What do you think about the consequences of this trial? Is there any chance of it actually bringing some kind of conclusion to the events, or is it just going to increase polarization in Egypt?
I'm afraid it's difficult to see it doing anything else other than increasing the polarization. It's not likely that a trial like this is going to persuade the hardline faction in the army to behave more gently, or it's very difficult to see how the chances of that going on. Egypt is a very interesting example of how a lot of journalism has misread the situation. Everybody reads Egypt from what's going on the street. Actually, the really critical thing that happened in the course of 2013 was a shift of power inside the military establishment. When Mubarak fell, a relatively moderate group of generals said, OK, we're going to relax things, we're going to liberalise things, this is the key to the future. That didn't work. And then a much harder line faction inside the army took over. And they're jammed in an almost impossible position. It's very, very difficult to see how any outside power, such as America or indeed neighbours, can help get them off the hook, to be honest. It's hard to see.
George, let's move on to another rather fascinating story all about a CIA double agent and his involvement in the terrorist attacks in Mumbai, and what questions over what the American government knew, what the Indian government knew, whether they were warned by the CIA. It's a fascinating story.
It is indeed. We've been puzzled for some time by why relations between the United States and India, pretty important relationship in its part of the world, have been so bad. And all the offered explanations to do with trade deals not going right and various diplomatic quarrels don't really seem to have explained it. Now there's a book coming out, and some of the contents were revealed in the Sunday Times yesterday. And what it suggests is that there was a CIA double agent whose English name, I mean, he'd been born in Pakistan, but his English name was David Headley, who had infiltrated Lashkar-e-Taiba, one of the groups in Pakistan very close to al-Qaeda. And obviously he'd done that with the intention probably of trying to help the CIA find bin Laden. But while he was doing all this, he was apparently the mastermind of the attack on Mumbai in 2008, in which 166 people were killed. You remember they came in from the sea and attacked one of the big hotels in Mumbai and various other locations. I mean, this was a major trauma in India. I happened to be in India at the time it was happening. And if it is true that it was a CIA double agent who was really important in doing all that and carried out the reconnaissance missions in Mumbai, that really would explain why relations between the Indian and American governments have been so bad for the past few years.
But on the CIA's side defense, they did say that they did warn the Indian authorities several times, but they, for some reason, didn't act.
Well, one of the other mysteries about the Mumbai attack is why the authorities appeared to have been, the various indications have been given that they had some information in advance, and it's very unclear what they did with it. They don't seem to have done anything very effective, and it could well be that the Americans, in fact, via Headley, were informing them. But with intelligence, the question you always have to ask is, was the warning actually, was it actionable? Was it specific enough for people to actually do things? We don't yet know. And the reason I've chosen this story is I think a great deal more will emerge about this over time.
George, shall we finish with a story on a great discovery of looted Nazi art found in Munich? Where do you think, what is the significance of this story?
Well, it turns out that for several years, the German police and tax investigators have been sitting on a collection of 1,500 paintings looted from a whole series of collectors back in the Second World War. Which had been concealed in a, as far as we can see, rather scruffy flat in Munich. One day they were doing a standard cash check on a train running between Switzerland and Germany. They found a man with an unusually large amount of euros on him. They let him go, but they were suspicious, and they raided his flat, and they found this collection of 1,500 pictures, which include pictures by Picasso, Matisse, Chagall, Renoir. I mean, it really is. I mean, you know, you don't get many treasure, finds of treasure in the modern world, but this really is a treasure find. I mean, every art curator in Europe must be slavering at the idea of being able to mount the first show of the best stuff from... These are paintings which have been gone for more than half a century. Nobody knew where they were. The story was that they'd been burnt at the end of the war in a bomb attack, so that they didn't exist anymore. Now, a new, an upper-end Picasso, that's $50, $60 million. An upper-end Matisse, $30 million. I mean, we're talking about some very valuable stuff. And the other set of people who will be slavering are the lawyers. Because, of course, there will be people claiming these paintings.
It will be quite a show if indeed it does go ahead. And some art curator does manage to put them all together. George Brock, head of journalism at City University here in London. Many thanks for joining us on the program.
My pleasure.
Coming up, we'll speak to Monica Skaidaloni after the municipal elections in Kosovo ended in disarray.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo,
to Shanghai,
to Berlin,
to Tel Aviv,
to Buenos Aires,
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Welcome back. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Voting in Kosovo's municipal elections ended in disarray on Sunday in the main ethnic Serb municipality. Intruders threw tear gas at a polling station in North Mitrovica, and that led to the early closure of all polling stations in the town. The election was supposed to be a chance for Serbia's government to show it was serious about normalizing relations with the Republic of Kosovo.
Well, that was a key condition for getting European Union membership talks underway. But ethnic Serbs in the north of the country have refused to recognize the legitimacy of the government in the south. And as far as most of them were concerned, voting in a Kosovo election would have been a betrayal of their identity. While Monocle's correspondent Guy Deloney has been spending election weekend in North Mitrovica and joins us now on the program. Guy, the election over the weekend was marred by quite a bit of violence and chaos. What can you tell us?
Well, the main chaos came at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, just as it became dark. A group of men stormed into one of the polling stations, which was in a primary school in the center of North Mitrovica. And from witness accounts, they were throwing tear gas canisters. And as the staff in there had to flee, the men started smashing up the ballot boxes. Earlier on in the day, there'd been accusations that groups of men had been hanging around the polling stations, intimidating people who'd been trying to go to vote. There was a boycott the vote campaign, which had been organized by Serb politicians or some Serb politicians in North Mitrovica and the other municipalities in North Kosovo. And it was being very successful throughout the day. It was clear that very few ethnic Serbs were turning out to vote in the election.
Guy, is there any idea who was responsible of these attacks?
Well, that's the big question. The Serbian government straight away is trying to point the finger at Serb nationalist extremists, as they've been putting it. In other words, the very kind of people who'd been organizing the boycott campaign. But in fact, the boycott campaigners are furious about this. They're saying that their campaign was working just fine. There was no need for them to disrupt the polling. They're rather suspicious about what's gone on. They said that it had become clear that very few ethnic Serbs were voting. So the only people who could have possibly benefited from the vote being disrupted in this way were those who actually wanted the vote to succeed in terms of the ethnic Serb turnout. So there's a great big argument going on, and we haven't heard the end of it.
Well, you mentioned the ethnic Serb turnout there and potentially being extremely low. Why was the Serbian government so keen to get ethnic Serbs to vote in this election in Kosovo?
Well, it's all to do with its European Union membership ambitions. And ahead of the vote, they were urging Serbs to vote almost as a patriotic duty to their homeland, that basically if they could show that they could work with Kosovo on an election to get ethnic Serbs in the north to play nicely and vote, this would show the European Union they were serious about this agreement to normalize relations that they've made with Pristina. And there was also in rather stern terms, a reminder that most ethnic Serbs in North Kosovo rely on jobs funded by Belgrade. And local politician Daniela Vujicic had this message for the boycott brigade.
All you guys, be good enough. If you don't want to accept your country, your own country, Republic of Serbia message, just be too good to don't go and get your salary every single month by Republic of Serbia. Just because if you don't believe to your country, okay, don't believe to your own pocket and don't go and get it, your salary.
So you'd be unsurprised to hear that a lot of ethnic Serbs here were feeling under a lot of pressure from the Serbian government to go out and vote. And despite that, they went ahead and boycotted.
Guy, has there been any sign whatsoever of a softening of approach by the Serbs in northern Kosovo to the ethnic Albanian-dominated government in the south?
No, I don't think there has been. The boycott campaign was very well organised, much more prominent than the posters for any of the candidates standing for election. And if it hadn't been for that tear gas attack, that's what we would have been talking about, the fact that there was a very successful boycott campaign. And here's one of the movement's leaders, Nebojša Jović.
We will never recognize independent institution of Kosovo or institution of Kosovo in the north. We really don't want to be a part of that kind of monster state.
A monster state, that's still the view of ethnic Serbs in North Kosovo, of the self-declared independent Republic of Kosovo.
Well, Guy, we've heard there from one of the leaders of the boycott movement, as you just mentioned. Are the Kosovos in the south, though, celebrating this election, though?
Not really. I mean, for them, it's business as usual. It's a municipal election. You'd get about a 30% turnout. It's standard fare, in a way. The reason this was a municipal election that could have had an international impact was because of what it would have said about relations between Serbia and the Republic of Kosovo and the path to European Union membership for Serbia. For the ethnic Albanians who form the majority in southern Kosovo, it was pretty much business as usual. And even in areas in southern Kosovo where there are large numbers of ethnic Serbs, the voting went ahead quite normally. It's only here in North Kosovo that it turned into something a little bit more exciting.
Considering that there is no significant turnout among the ethnic Serbs in the north, how much will these elections have credibility in the end?
I don't think they'll have any sort of credibility at all. The votes haven't been counted because immediately this tear gas attack happened in Mitrovica. The security organisation, the OSCE, rather dramatically pulled out all its people wearing ballistic helmets, flak jackets, and driving away at top speed in their armoured land cruisers, which was completely over the top, really. But that was the end of the election here. They also pulled out in another municipality in North Kosovo, leaving half the ballot boxes behind, which a lot of people here are very scornful about. Here's an international organisation which couldn't manage to organise an election, they're saying. So the results here have no credibility at all. The only question is now, are they going to be asked to vote again? And if so, when and how?
And Guy, finally, just very quickly, what kind of reaction do you think we can expect from political onlookers in Brussels?
Well, I don't think they're going to be terribly impressed. But then again, you could say that this is all their fault anyway. It's only 6 months since Serbia and Kosovo agreed to normalize relations. And you really need to prepare the ground in North Kosovo if you're going to have to ask people to vote against their identity, which is what people were thinking here they were having to do. They considered themselves citizens of Serbia, and they were being asked to vote in an election called by the Republic of Kosovo. Nobody has actually consulted the North Kosovo Serbs on what's going on between Belgrade and Pristina, and that makes people here furious.
That was Monocle's Guy Deloni in North Mitrovica.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Marcus Hippie.
The time is 8:24 here in London, which makes it 10:24 in Istanbul. We head there now to talk with our man there, Caleb Lauer, is joins us now. Welcome to the show, Caleb. First of all, there are quite a few political parties in Turkey. The number is actually over 70 now, and there is one new one again.
That's right. The newest party is called the HDP, which stands for the Halk Democratic Partisi, which means the People's Democratic Party. It was formed last week, and as you said, there are already dozens and dozens of parties in Turkey, so the fact that this is a new party is not necessarily the news. But this party is significant because it is founded by former members of the BDP, which is, as many people will know, is affiliated with the PKK and represents the Kurdish struggle in the Turkish parliament. Now, this is not a split from the BDP. This is formed by people who did not leave the BDP out of dissatisfaction, but they left for a purpose. Both parties, the BDP and the new party, the HDP, both have the moral backing of Abdullah Öcalan, who is the leader of the sort of the recognized leader of the Kurdish struggle. And the purpose of this new party is to draw in support from people who tend to be sort of left-wing in politics, that are uncomfortable with the PKK affiliation of the BDP. They're trying to get people that are, as I said, left-wing, people that are Alevi, people that don't necessarily identify with the Sunni rhetoric of the BDP. And the question is, will it work? On paper, this is a fairly progressive-looking party. They're calling for 10% representation from LGBT people, 50% representation of women. But can they attract progressives? Can they attract left-wingers? And can they attract Alevis? All of which have their own parties that they tend to vote for.
But Caleb, surely there has to be some concerns that this new party will split the vote.
That is the major question, especially as we approach local elections in March 2014. The AK Party has dominated Istanbul, the municipality of Istanbul, for years. Now, what has recently happened is that a star of the left, his name is Mustafa Sarıgül, has rejoined the CHP. Now, the CHP is the only party that really has a serious hope of contending for the municipality of Istanbul to win the mayoral election. Now, Mustafa Sarıgül is a left-wing guy. He's a progressive guy, and the CHP is a left-wing party, Social Democratic Party. This new party is also going to field candidates in the election, and the concern is that does this new party take away votes from Sarıgül, from the CHP? And this is a major concern, especially after the Gezi Park protests. People were saying, look, we have to win Istanbul municipality. We have to win this. So the best way to do this is to field a common candidate. And this was the rhetoric for a long time after Gezi Park, this idea of a common candidate. And what they've done in the last week is essentially get the best person that has, or sorry, the person with the best chance of beating the AK Party in Istanbul to field himself as a candidate, at the same time as putting forward a party that will take away votes from this candidate. So this is a real dilemma that the left and opponents of the AK Party are going to have to face.
Caleb, let's finish by talking about headscarves in the Turkish parliament. Last week, for the first time for decades, women MPs were wearing headscarves in there for women, actually. How significant is this story?
It's a major threshold that Turkey has passed with the entering into parliament of women with headscarves. For years, decades, this was a taboo. And essentially, women in parliament wearing a headscarf was the last taboo. People will remember that a few years ago, girls were not allowed to wear headscarves into universities. This has been dropped. Lately, we've seen, in the last month, we've seen teachers be allowed to wear headscarves, and now finally, parliamentary deputies have worn the headscarf. This shows that the taboo of the headscarf is no longer a taboo. It is just merely political controversy, and people in Turkey are very, very pleased that life has gone on. The running of the parliament did not come to a stop. This did not result in a crisis, and people are very, very happy that this shows that Turkey is essentially past this very, very artificial and unfortunate contentious topic.
That was our man in Istanbul, Caleb Lauer. Thank you very much for this.
In the next half hour of the program, we'll be reviewing the Spanish newspapers with Monocle producer Alid John, and we'll also get a grand tour of the new headquarters of London Auctioneers Bonhams with architect Alec Lifshitz.
The thing is to create a little bit of magic and to turn weakness into strength, to turn a very narrow, as I say, a very narrow and unpromising approach into something that inspires you.
But with the time at 8:30 exactly on the dot, very precise timing from us here, here's David Spencer with the news headlines.
Thank you very much indeed. Ousted Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi has arrived at a Cairo police academy to face trial on charges of inciting violence. The country is on high alert ahead of today's procedural hearing, with his Muslim Brotherhood party calling for mass protests. US Secretary of State John Kerry will hold talks in Saudi Arabia later, with Egypt expected to feature on the agenda. But the kingdom's frustration with a lack of progress on the Syria crisis is set to dominate proceedings. And investigations continuing in the United States into what caused a collision between two skydiving planes in Wisconsin. All 11 passengers in both planes survived when the aircraft collided at 12,000 feet. Outbreaks of violence have marred key elections in Kosovo. Masked men forced the early closure at the main polling centre in an ethnically mixed Kosovan town during the municipal elections. A move to return Berlin's electricity grid to public ownership has failed. A referendum has seen around 24% of those eligible to vote cast their ballots in favour of the initiative, but that's just short of the required 25%. The mayor of Toronto, Rob Ford, has used his regular radio broadcast to apologise for any mistakes that he may have made, but he has again refused to quit after police said they'd recovered a video appearing to show him smoking from a crack pipe. Those are latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, David. David will be back at the top of the hour with another check of your world headlines. It is 17:31 in Seoul, 11:31 in Nairobi, and 8:31 here in London. Now, London auctioneers Bonhams have a proud history, but had a stuffy image compared to their competitors. Under a new boss, Robert Brooks, the August House is pulling itself by the bootstraps and showing a bit of leg in the process, if their beautiful new headquarters on London's new Bond Street is anything to go by.
On a crisp and clear autumn day, Rob Bound was given a tour of Bonham's rebooted HQ by the architect Alex Lifshitz, who has gutted and rethought what was once a warren of carpet, low ceilings and interminable corridors to make a light, airy and fairly spectacular place to view and buy art, jewellery, wine and even classic racing cars. Here is a sneak peek of the tour he was given for this week's edition of Culture.
The first thing you might notice is that this is one of the narrowest facades in Bond Street, number 101. Very elegant Edwardian building, probably 3 or 4 metres wide. And I hope you'll get a surprise when you go in, because from being the narrowest, it becomes the grandest as you walk through the door.
Oh, wow. It is huge already inside. I guess this is a floor to the very top. Story kind of atrium right at the front of the building.
Yes, we've taken every floor of this building out, so it's about it's just under 20 meters high. It's a very elegant, slender atrium. It's a light fitting, effectively. It's a lantern on the street. We can light it, as you can see, on every story. These light fittings, linear light fittings that are concealed, shine light upwards, and we can change the color. We can create a really magical effect on the street.
This is quite amazing. It's not an unpromising doorway, but it is a narrow one, and this is quite an amazing space to walk into.
Well, just to say, just before we move on, we can also exhibit things in that space. So we can have Formula One cars racing down the walls. We can have objects hung up there, and there's anchoring points that allow us to carry great weight. So it's a space that can be curated, that can actually have some excitement in it, not just the space itself.
You've got immediately a pleasant danger of a lot of people banging into each other in the hallway there as they look upwards, right? I suppose that's kind of the aim of the architect, to inspire a bit of awe as well as to be usable, I suppose.
Well, it's always the thing is to create a little bit of magic and to turn weakness into strength, to turn a very narrow, as I say, a very narrow and unpromising approach into something that inspires you.
And now here we are in what you'd probably regard as the regular hallway. We've got some navy dressing on the walls, and we've actually got some paintings in here. This is looking a little bit more like an auction house.
Well, we're in the Bond Street sale room, which is quite a grand sale room. You can see about 6 metres high, over 20 metres long and 15 metres wide, of that sort of proportion. Very classic shaped room with a variety of different objects on show here to show. This is the sort of opening event exhibition to show the different types of things that Bonham sell, from the Fragonard, which we're passing on the right, which is going to go for upwards of 17 to 20 million, to wine at £80,000 a case on the left. So a lot of different things shown here.
We are here in this sort of main hallway, which is a sort of greatest hits of the stuff that Bonhams sells. It's a sort of broad array of stuff. Is that a bit of a challenge as an architect as well, having to, as you said, when we walked into the atrium, the opening atrium, have to incorporate potentially racing cars for sale as much as paintings and wine?
Well, and Bonhams have a speciality in selling bits of Space Rocket as well. So we
bits of Space Rocket, is that a specialty? Well, that's the nichest of niches.
Well, that was the first exhibition I saw in there. So bits of NASA's old kit. So things become collectible in a way that is unpredictable. So these are very versatile spaces. I think one of the challenges, and very interesting challenges, how to make a space which can be lit in entirely different ways, and we'll go down to sale room one in a second. You'll see a large piece of modern art, modern West African art, displayed in a completely different way in the same sort of space, again with daylight, but completely different environment. It's a space that's sort of pregnant with possibility. This is the top sale room two, and it's more directed towards smaller objects, so it's about 4.5 meters high, and it's ideal for ceramics and watches, jewellery, the smaller objects.
And this has definitely got much more of a sort of hushed. This feels like more of a traditional cell room, more of a traditional display room. We've got the navy blue fabric on the walls again. This feels like it's a place for objets rather than statement pieces, perhaps.
Yes, but at the touch of a button, and I'm at a button at the moment.
He's with a sort of tablet console on the wall.
We can change the colour of light. You'll see this was decked out for a party on opening night with lots of sort of disco lighting, and here we go. We can get disco lighting, as you can see.
The technicians are unmoved by your display.
The technicians will become moved in a second. Saturation up. So there you go. So
this feels almost like daylight now in here.
Yeah, we can dial up daylight. And of course, that's important with jewellery when you're showing gems and so on, that you get the right light.
It's the world's slowest disco. That's what I like about it. Well, I'm lulled. It's a sort of lullaby.
I'm the world's slowest disco operator, obviously.
That was Alex Lifshutz showing Monocle's Rob Bound around auctioneers Bonham's new headquarters. And you can hear the full tour on this week's edition of Culture, which airs at 1900 hours London time. That is at 8 a.m. in Auckland and 1400 hours in New York.
Marcus, I think you'd be a very good disco operator.
You think so?
Yeah. I think you've got some good moves.
You haven't seen me at the Christmas party yet.
Well, a couple weeks away. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this to explore the ancient history of social media.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight. From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delorme. From Monocle.
From Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Learning from a master is a privilege in any sphere. To nurture ideas for the arts, Rolex's Mentor and Protégé initiative has been teaming leading practitioners with promising protégés around the globe. Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound hopped over to Venice to talk to some protégés and mentors.
Everybody's moved out of institutional thinking and behavior and moved into something that's way easier, more honest, more direct, and more collaborative. As an artist, it's not interesting to be a private genius. What you want is to be part of a movement.
You can watch Rob Bound's film on monocle.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 17:40 in Tokyo, 10:40 in Helsinki, and 8:40 here in London. Now, for many, the word social media began with the advent of websites like Facebook and Twitter, but author Tom Standage thinks otherwise. In his new book, Writing on the Wall, Standage argues that the term actually refers to a very old idea, which has been in existence for hundreds, if not thousands, of years.
From Cicero's letters in Roman politics to coffee houses and discussion platforms in the 17th century, it is clear that social media is not a new phenomenon, but has unexpectedly deep roots. To find out more, Monocle producer Daphne Denny spoke to Tom Standage. She began by asking about the premise of the book.
The idea is that you don't need a digital network. You don't need the internet to do social media. All the internet does is make it go faster. So what I'm doing in the book is I'm looking at the examples from history of where we've had social media ecosystems that have arisen in the past. And as far as I can tell, it goes back to the late Roman Republic. That's the first time you get this person-to-person horizontal exchange of information, allowing you to have a sort of wide area distributed discussion. And for me, that's the sort of essence of social media, that it's media you get from other people rather than being broadcast sort of impersonally through a box in the corner like the TV or the radio. So we see this in the Roman period because the Romans are sending each other letters on papyrus rolls or on wax tablets that look surprisingly like modern iPads or smartphones. And these are being carried to and fro by messengers. And in the same way that the internet makes the copying and delivery of information very cheap for us today, the Romans had slavery, which made it very cheap and quick for them. So slavery was the sort of Roman broadband. And as a result, you get this social ecosystem arising in that period because you've also got a pretty high level of literacy. So we see people like Cicero and Pliny the Elder are getting the news through their friends, filtered through their friends, and they're also distributing books and speeches and, in fact, the Roman newspaper as well in a social manner. So that's why I say it goes back to the Roman period. And then I have a whole load of other examples between then and now.
So what's your favourite example of a social media ecosystem that you describe in the book?
Well, the Roman one, I have to say, I'm particularly fond of. But probably my other favourite one is the ecosystem of coffee houses that arose in London in particular in the late 17th century. And what you've got there is coffee houses where you go to read the latest pamphlets and newsletters and early newspapers called newsbooks, and then possibly write your own responses. And coffee houses were sort of sorted by subject. So there were particular ones you'd go to if you were in a particular business or interested in a particular subject. And that also meant that you could network more easily with the people within them. And if you wrote a pamphlet aimed at a particular audience, then you would leave it lying around in the right coffee houses where those sorts of people would go. And pamphlets would also be carried from coffee house to coffee house and sent by post and so on. So again, you've got this circulation of stuff. And we see in Samuel Pepys's diary just how alluring it was. He was always writing thence to the coffee house, and you never knew who you'd meet or what you might discover, and you'd soon find that you'd whiled away several hours in the coffee house networking and exchanging information with people that you hadn't previously met.
I suppose the one thing that I would argue about is that all these examples that you're saying are sort of the higher intellectual spheres of society, and I think what social media now is sometimes criticised for is that really anyone can go to the internet and actually voice an opinion that perhaps isn't true and goes viral anyway, or voice something that shouldn't be actually in the public sphere. So is that sort of like maybe the difference between social media now and in the past?
Yes and no. So it's true that access to these social media environments before was something for the rich and the privileged elite. And it's gradually become more democratized. And obviously, it's much more democratized now. And we are within striking distance of anyone in the world who wants to get on the internet and publish stuff being able to do so. That's going to be possible in the next sort of 10 or 20 years, I think. That said, this criticism that the wrong people will publish the wrong things is actually timeless. Every time there's been an increase in availability of publishing infrastructure, the people who were previously in charge have complained that this has led to an influx of people who they don't approve of saying things they don't approve of. So even Erasmus, in the time of Martin Luther uses the printing press to mount a terrifically successful social media campaign against the Catholic Church that we call the Reformation today. And Erasmus complains that the trouble with all these pamphlets flying around Europe is that no one's reading the classics anymore. Similarly, attempts to control printing presses after Luther are justified on the basis that by printers who want a monopoly, that they, you know, they don't want the wrong people saying the wrong thing. And so you just get this over and over again that, oh no, we can't possibly have just anyone publishing stuff because that would be terrible. So this is usually denounced as sort of trivialization or coarsening of discourse. But one man's trivialization is another man's democratization. So I think actually we need to look at both sides of this. And we also need to look at this with historical perspective. So this complaint today, oh, we can't just let anyone publish on Twitter because then, you know, some people will say things we don't approve of. Well, actually, you know, this is a very old complaint.
And finally, yes, indeed, social is and has been for a long time, but the media is different, the medium is different, and the way that this information goes from one person to another is a dematerialized way, which also has changed quite a lot in the way that we, I think, consumed the news. There was, in what you described, there is a very material contact between people. Even, you know, you were saying slaves are people that bring a letter from one place to another. Do you think that's also a slight, actually important difference to like sort of be marked?
Well, I think, I mean, I'm completely upfront about the fact that obviously the internet is different in the sense that it's global, it's instant, it's searchable, and it's apparently permanent. We don't actually know how permanent the stuff that's on it is. So in that respect, the social media ecosystems we have today are different from the historical ones. That said, the similarities, I think, are close enough to be informative because we get these same social reactions to the use of social media in both then and now. So I think that said, we get the same social reactions then and now. So I think that, you know, there's a great deal we can learn from history by looking at these older systems. The other thing is this idea that social media today is sort of completely prevents us from talking to people in real life. I'm not sure that if you look at surveys, actually, people tend to actually be seeing less and less of a distinction between online and offline activity. So I've noticed in particular that although, you know, I talk to people, some of whom I've never actually met in person, I've also noticed that when I travel, I meet lots of people I otherwise wouldn't because they see that I'm in their city on Twitter. And so it actually increases the number of real-world connections that I make. And another phenomenon we see is that the use of online communications allows people to concentrate their FaceTime on the people for whom they regard that as most valuable. So I really think this kind of, you know, it's either online or offline and that one must, you know, operate at the expense of the other when in fact they can reinforce each other. I think that's a better way of looking at things.
That was Tom Standage, author of Writing on the Wall, Social Media, the First 2,000 Years, speaking to Monocle's Daphne Denny.
In a moment, we'll leave through the Spanish front pages, but first, to get in the mood, this is a Spanish classic, Hijo de la Luna by Mecano. That was Hijo de la Luna by the Spanish band Mecano.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Marcus Hippy. It's time now to have a flick through this morning's Spanish front pages. I'm delighted to say I'm joined now in the studio. We're joined now in the studio with Alid John, Monocle producer, and also cycling extraordinaire.
Why'd you bring that up, Phil?
Well, because I just noticed you're wearing your very tight cycling shorts right now. But I'm glad you made it.
Sadly, there's no webcam in the studio. No one else can see that.
What are the big news on Spanish press today, Alex?
Mark, so what, you don't want to talk about my cycling shorts?
Yeah.
Okay,
I think it's a bit of
Spanish press. Spanish press. Apologies for my attire, but moving on. So we've got a couple of security stories, a third domestic security story, and then something a little bit more cultural to finish with. So let's begin with the two security ones. These are NSA stories. Goes without saying that Spain, France, Germany have all been playing a rather rancorous role versus the NSA, you might say. But there's two stories here today in El País and across the broader Spanish broadsheet press that suggests that the NSA has actually been helping the CNI, which is the the Spanish Domestic Intelligence Center, that's the National Intelligence Center, to collect data and to understand the data that they collect, because they don't have the capability to do so. So two stories. One is quite a nice little story that the NSA helped track kidnapped aid workers back in 2009. That's the kidnapping of victims Roque Pascual, Alicia Gamez, and Albert Villalta. And they were kidnapped when they were en route from the Mauritanian capital, Nouakchott, to the port city of Nouadhibou, before taking across the border to Mali. That's in the Islamic Maghreb. The other story, which is, it's less positive, but it's a sign from what General Keith Alexander, the NSA director, he stated that domestic intelligence services such as the CNI and France's DGSE were in fact giving over information because they didn't have the capability to understand it. So this is a much more serious allegation that's in El País today. They've got a huge spread on it, that the CNI was routinely giving over personal information to the NSA just so that they can understand it, in effect.
Has there been any comments made by the officials about this story yet?
Well, other than the people cited in the article, it's got quite a lot of traction across the Spanish press, as you might imagine, but Snowden's leaks are just trickling out bit by bit, some with positive effects, as the NSA with the aid workers story. And this one here obviously has much more wide-ranging.
But it is quite interesting, because when these allegations first came out, many people were blaming the NSA, including many European leaders and people in members of parliament in Brussels, saying, you know, why is the NSA doing this? They shouldn't be doing this. But then after closer examination and analysis, it looks like many of these European countries have been helping the NSA and handing over the information.
Yeah, well, the issue has never been whether intelligence agencies spy on other agencies or other diplomatic personnel. The issue for most people, I believe, I would say, especially as a journalist, you're concerned not when they're focusing on politicians, but more on when they're exchanging information about Joe Smith on the street.
And there are allegations that something like 60 million Spanish calls were monitored in a month as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Keith Alexander, he said, and I quote, "They cite as evidence screenshots of the results of a web tool used for data management purposes, but both they and the person who stole the data did not understand what they were looking at, hence why they gave it over to the NSA." I mean, there's a lot of back and forth going on here.
There really isn't a day without news on something that's related to the NSA. But moving forward, what else would you like to talk about today? What have you spotted from the papers?
So this is the domestic security story of ETA, rumbling on as ever, rumbling on hopefully and quite positively towards disarmament. ETA is quite an interesting take on it in El País. Again, this is their youth leaders, because most of their leadership, they're kind of hard-nosed, died-in-the-wool ETA brigands, they're all in jail. But the youth ranks are contacting the jailed leaders for the location of weapons caches, which, because they're young and weren't involved in the organisation for many years, they don't have the knowledge of where those weapons are stored. So they're contacting Miquel Albizu and Soledad Iparraguirre, long-time ETA leaders who have been in jail in France since 2004 and who have vast knowledge of the apparatus of the group.
And where do you see this all going to? What's happening next? What's the impression? What is to be expected?
Well, according to the International Verification Committee, it's not the catchiest of names, headed by Ram Manikanam, they maintain contact with ETA and they are preparing the ground for its dissolution. The dialogue very much in the press is that they are heading towards disarmament, and that can only be a good thing.
Well, what prospects do you think there are for some kind of a lasting peace deal? You know, over the weekend in Madrid, we saw that there were protests because a European court released several of these Basque separatists convicted of terror attacks. Thousands of people turned out onto the streets of Madrid to protest that move. How likely do you think it is that we will see some kind of a resolution that will be, you know, that will please both sides?
Yeah, I mean, there is a potential stumbling block, and that is that some ETA factions are reluctant to proceed with disarmament until the Spanish government agrees to negotiate over the collective situation of its inmates. So it's one of those, kind of a catch-22. They have to disarm, but they have to wait till their prisoners are released.
Alex, you also promised us a culture story. Should we finish with it?
Sorry, yeah, very quickly. Okay. So this is a lovely little story from Madrid. If you've ever been to Madrid, you may have passed by some of the disused and slightly seedy shopping arcades.
It's not doing very well, is it?
No, I mean, well, Madrid I love, but there's these old grand shopping arcades which you might see more commonly in Paris and parts of London as well. Madrid, they were introduced in the same sort of era after they were built in Paris, and Unfortunately, with the kind of with the move of the middle classes out from the city centre to the suburbs, the arcades became disused. They became homes to the odd sex shop and a bit seedy. Smelt like urine, that kind of thing.
Oh, delightful.
But a huge, a new generation of entrepreneurs, they're determined to rescue Madrid's arcades from abandonment. And that can only be a positive thing.
So what?
Who's actually going to be paying for this, though? Because we know that Spain is struggling through the worst recession in its history. You know, we've heard horror stories of garbage not being collected on the streets of Madrid. Where are they going to possibly find the money to redevelop it and bring some new life back to these abandoned arcades?
Yeah, well, they're looking for private investment predominantly. They're not going to get it from the state. I believe Madrid might hand out some local authority cash, but they're entrepreneurs and they're going to gather the venture capital themselves.
Well, Aled, unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today. We're going to have to leave it there. It's a pleasure, as always, seeing you in the studio, especially in your cycling gear.
Thank you. That's actually all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Barbara Feeney, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Andrea Alacorn. Our studio manager was Chris Gilvers today. Up next after the news is The Urbanist. Stay tuned for the briefing at midday in London, 7 a.m. in New York. Phil will be back with Dominic Reynolds for Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Marcus Hippi.
And me, Phil Hahn. Thanks very much for listening and goodbye.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness to words that moved nations. It's dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time, it tells history. Rolex.